If you are a fan of defining terms, you're going to absolutely love this video. Recently, Jordan Peterson went on Jubilee's Surrounded to debate 20 atheists at the same time, and it was, it's fair to say, a little bit confusing. So, let's crack on and see what light we can shed on this whole messy thing. Before we get started, I do just want to acknowledge that a debate setting such as this one is really quite tricky. It's high-pressured, stressful, and you're bound to end up giving weaker versions of your overall argument. So just take this as an analysis of Peterson's specific claims in this debate. Also, I've deliberately not watched any other reactions to this, so I apologize in advance for any similarities to other ones you might have seen. But anyway, let's get started.
My first claim, atheists reject God. But they don't understand what they're rejecting.
As a non-believer myself, this claim strikes me as quite fun, so let's see how it goes. The first person to approach Peterson, Cade, raises an interesting objection. I'll just play a section of it now.
But I think that you have a reductive view of what atheism is. You've defined religion so broadly to include any sort of having aim in life, any sort of cultural archetypes, or having a metaphorical substrate. And atheism to you is a very specific type of like three people in the world that are these Raskolnikov type of, they want to get away with a perfect murder. It seems like you have the reductive view of what an atheist is.
Essentially, Cade suggests there are two different ideas of God at play here, and says that Peterson broadens the definition of God beyond what most believers conceive God to be, and indeed what most atheists conceive God to be. Peterson claims the opposite. He suggests that atheists have a reductive idea of God, and that this is what they're rejecting when they say they are atheists. This leaves it open for the atheists to not disbelieve in Peterson's God, but to disbelieve in some other caricatured God. This is how Peterson defines the word God in this section, drawing from the book of Exodus.
The divine is fundamentally unknowable. It's a pinnacle experience, and that people in their finitude have to be shielded from a comprehensive vision of the basis of reality.
He rules out the more cartoonish ideas of God, like an old man in the sky, and then says the following.
It's the same claim, for example, that you're a finite creature, and that you face something that in the final analysis is unknowable, and that you have to establish a relationship with it regardless of your inability to perceive or even withstand perceiving the whole.
Now, I don't fundamentally have a problem with this definition. I don't think it's Peterson's whole definition of God, as we'll come to later, but you can just define terms by stipulation within the context of a debate. My maths textbook defines a graph in a way totally at odds with everyday speech, but that doesn't matter because it tells me what it means. The trouble is that here, Peterson seems to want to say that there is something more correct about his definition of God. This would then justify the claim that atheists do not know what they're rejecting. They would not be rejecting this more substantial idea of God that Peterson claims to put forward. But it's not clear whether Peterson has established that his definition is in some way better. There can be good reasons to prefer one definition to another in a given context. If we assume that the basic purpose of language is to communicate ideas to one another, then we can evaluate the utility of a definition based on whether it coheres with the way the term is generally used within that context, or, as it's sometimes put, meaning is use. But under this criterion, Peterson's definition of God is pretty at odds with how most atheists, and indeed a large amount of theists, understand the term. For example, St. Thomas Aquinas famously defines God along many properties in Summa Contra Gentiles. God is eternal, incorporeal, divinely simple, all-perfect, omniscient, personal, and has free will. Sure, he says these are analogous properties and that they will mean something different when they're applied to God versus when they're applied to a human, but this is still significantly more detailed than a definition of God as merely something defined in our relationship to the infinite. Aquinas is also clear that God is not merely being itself or reality, but something over and above everything else that exists. To quote Aquinas directly, we may conclude that God is not being in general, but individual being. That is, God is defined as an individual. He's not an old man sitting on a white cloud, but his characterization is nonetheless very substantial. Aquinas sets out a clear set of propositions for his definition of God, and they've remained pretty much the gold standard for descriptions of God within Catholicism, which is the largest Christian denomination in the world. When Aquinas says, "The fool saith in his heart, there is no God," this is the kind of God he's talking about. My problem with Peterson's definition of God here is not that it's incorrect, you can stipulate definitions however you like, but that it seems believing in this kind of God is totally compatible with what most atheists state that they believe. The God that most atheists reject is the God of Aquinas rather than the God of Peterson. For example, I do not believe in God, but I would be perfectly happy to say there might be mysterious pinnacle experiences that are impossible to fully comprehend from a first-person perspective. I would just call them mystical experiences. I'm also happy to say that we are finite beings constantly in confrontation with the infinite. In our everyday lives, we are continually navigating this vast realm of infinite possibilities for our actions. We could make a cup of tea, or we could go to the shops, or we could start working on the first draft of the great American novel, or we could run off to live in Fiji. As we live, we reduce this set of infinite possibilities down to a singular set of actual things that we do. So, yes, in this sense, we are in confrontation with the infinite. But I don't think that atheists in general deny this, or if they do, this isn't because they're atheists, but because they believe something else. So I don't think the claim, atheists do not understand what they're rejecting, can be justified on this premise. Peterson seems to want to say something like, atheists reject God, but God is partly a confrontation with the infinite or the unknowable, but atheists don't reject that, so they must be misunderstanding what they're rejecting. But this is not how most atheists understand God, and they're not strawmanning the theist position by doing this. I would wager that most theists mean something closer to Aquinas' definition of God than Peterson's. After all, Aquinas is potentially the most influential Christian theologian ever. The trouble is, and this will become a bit of a theme in this video, when an argument simply degrades into two people using the same word in different ways, then no substantive argumentation can actually take place. Peterson isn't even really disagreeing with his interlocutor. He's simply using the word atheist in a way that is totally unfamiliar to the atheist he is talking to. We come across a similar issue a couple of speakers later with Greg. But first, if you want to avoid messy argumentation on your newsfeed, then you should check out today's very kind sponsor, Ground News. Ground News is a website and app that gathers related articles from thousands of sources around the world in one place so you can compare how different outlets cover the same story. Every story comes with a clear breakdown of the political bias, factuality, ownership, and headlines of the reporting sources, with ratings backed by independent news monitoring organizations. Ground News are very kindly offering anyone who uses my link or scans my QR code 40% off their Vantage plan as a special deal, so I highly encourage you to snap this up. For instance, let's see how left and right-wing publications differ on a judge allowing 14 states to continue their lawsuit against Elon Musk's new Doge department. While left-wing sources focused on the power Elon Musk might wield in government, right-wing sources pointed out that the judge dismissed claims against Donald Trump himself. That is, they chose to focus on different aspects of the same story. I especially like the blind spots feed, which highlights stories that are disproportionately covered by either the left or the right. This feed just helps readers step into the other side's news reality and understand the different narratives that can shape their beliefs, such as left-wing news sources missing a small recent rise in Trump's approval rating, or right-wing sources missing the potential effect tariffs have had on the US tourist industry. I don't have a lot of time to keep up with the news, and certainly not to examine every single article I read for bias. So receiving my Ground News Roundup at the end of every day means I can get a variety of news opinions, learn which sources to trust, and make the world less of a bewildering mess. I genuinely do read this at the end of every day, and I found it incredibly helpful. Ground News is giving my viewers 40% off their unlimited access Vantage plan. They've become my go-to news source, and I really hope that you'll check them out. But anyway, back to the video. Greg points to the phenomenon of polysemy, where Peterson and the standard atheist seem to just be using this term God in fundamentally different ways. That is, they're not disagreeing, they're just miscommunicating. In response, Peterson defines God as conscience, drawing from the prophet Elijah as an example of this definition of God, in addition to Cardinal John Henry Newman, who is a very cool thinker, by the way.
So Elijah, the prophet Elijah, defined God in the Old Testament as the voice of conscience within.
Okay.
That's a definition.
So you're saying it, by that definition of God, I guess, see, this is kind of goes back to where I'm saying initially.
I'm not defining it. Elijah defined
it. Okay, so as Elijah defines
it's
God.
It's defined that way in Jonah, too.
Okay, so as
Cardinal Newman also defined it that way.
I'm sure you know many people who defined it that way.
I don't want to go too far down biblical hermeneutics, but as far as Newman is concerned, I always interpreted him as saying that the voice of conscience comes from God rather than that it is God. These are two very different propositions. Very few atheists would say that conscience doesn't exist. Most of us feel our conscience every day, or at least I would hope so. But it's quite another thing to claim that the conscience has a divine cause. But I'm not sure that Peterson is saying that conscience even does have a divine cause. He seems to be saying that conscience is God. That is, conscience defines God. And the issue I have with the definition of God as conscience is that it again seems to leave out an awful lot of what theism traditionally implies. For example, the English religious philosopher John Hick talks about eschatological verification. Contrary to many philosophers of his day, he held that aspects of theism could be empirically verified or falsified. It's just that they would have to be verified after death. That is, if Christianity is true, then when I die, I should continue to have conscious experience and eventually find myself in heaven, hell, or perhaps purgatory. This is not insignificant at all. It's relevant to the rest of my eternity. And I worry that attempting to define God as conscience would leave quite a lot of this kind of stuff out. Later in the video, Peterson himself says he can't speak to matters of eternal life or eternal suffering, but this does seem to cut off quite a large amount of what most people think is significant about religion. I don't just think this is an objection atheists would raise, it seems to reduce the significance of theistic belief for theists as well. After all, if God simply is conscience, then there probably are no atheists, except maybe psychopaths. So, at the very least, there is no substantive disagreement happening here. For the second time, a dispute about definitions has been blown up to be much larger than it actually is. Of course, as we'll see later, I think Peterson only views conscience as one aspect of God and does have a more substantial idea in mind. But then, when the atheist denies God, he clearly isn't denying the existence of conscience, but some other aspect of what is traditionally called God. And maybe Peterson calls this God, or maybe just other theists do. Again, I think that the Aquinas-style definition is characteristic of the kind of thing that atheists deny. So, the questions that I would ask Peterson here are, A, can we sit down and spell out the definitional properties of God for the context of this conversation? And B, if you and the atheist are simply using different definitions of God and actually agree on the existence of conscience or the incomprehensible, can we admit that we're not actually in dispute, but that the atheist does disbelieve in these other ways that the word God has been defined, including by some of the most influential theologians in history? That is, Peterson may have a different definition of God, but the atheist doesn't misunderstand what they mean when they say, "I don't believe in God." But anyway, moving on.
My next claim is that morality and purpose cannot be found within science.
Right. Let's see how Peterson justifies this point. And we'll have to glue together a few different parts of the conversations to do this.
Science has to exist within a moral framework that isn't in itself scientific. Scientists have to prioritize their attention towards something before they can even engage in observation.
Okay.
And that act of prioritization of attention is a value-predicated act. And so I can continue. There's all sorts of things we have to assume about science before it can take place.
Peterson's position here, as I understand it, is that science will have to presuppose some morality or value in order to conduct scientific inquiry. Throughout these conversations, two different meanings for these words emerge. Sometimes they're used in the narrow sense to mean moral values, like the value of truth in and of itself. That is, the belief that truth is a substantively good thing worth seeking in all cases. The second sense is far wider, and it's simply used to mean a criterion for organizing attention or action. So, when I choose to pay attention to one thing over another, I implicitly value the thing I'm paying attention to more than the things I'm not paying attention to, at least in that moment. The difference between these meanings is really significant. When someone says there is a value to truth, they normally mean that truth itself is a good thing, capable of producing normativity and dictating how we ought to act. They might say we are duty-bound to study the truth, or that having true beliefs is inherently better than having false ones. This is not merely meant to be an instrumental claim about truth's utility, but a substantial normative claim that isn't relative to any agent. When Aquinas or Plato argue that beauty, goodness, and truth are all related, they are not talking instrumentally. They mean these things are capital G good. They're not simply desired, but desirable in themselves. Peterson has an extended conversation about whether science can explain morality, and again, we run into definitional disputes. Peterson's interlocutor, Brian, argues that scientific methods can uncover how morality came to be from the outside. He chooses a biological evolutionary story, which would later be supplemented by a sociological one. Peterson seems to think this is insufficient, and then they go on a long tangent about animals predicting the future, at which point Brian is kind of unfortunately voted out. I think the point that Peterson is trying to make here is just the fact that science by itself can't tell us how to live. That is, it can't explain which moral system is the correct one. I don't have any issue with this, but it seems like it's just restating a very well-known philosophical problem, the is-ought gap, the idea that we can't infer from how things are to how things ought to be. But then, if this is true, why not just say that? The is-ought gap is very widely recognized, and I think it really would clear up some of the confusion here. He later says that science rules out questions of value a priori, which I also agree with. Science is an empirical discipline concerned with predicting observations, not dictating values to us. But it's difficult to tell if this is exactly what he's getting at, because the whole point is put so obscurely. Likewise, of course, science presupposes a set of values, but I don't see why an atheist would deny this. In fact, there is a whole field of philosophy of science that looks at scientific values. They aim to answer questions like, what defines a scientific question? What is the domain of science? And what makes a good scientific theory? Like any behavior, science does have to direct its attention and prioritize some actions over others, but I don't see how this is at all at odds with atheism. We get a bit more light in the next conversation, where Peterson defines religion as the realm of value and meaning.
If you're saying that morality and purpose cannot come from science, is the opposite of that true, that morality and purpose can only come from God?
That's a way of defining it, yes.
Okay.
That's right. That's good. So I would say that with regard to the first claim, say, atheists don't understand what they're rejecting, because I would say, by definition, God is the unity upon which moral claims are based. That's okay. A definition, right?
This is a bit similar to something he said earlier in the video about atheists being more religious than they think. And he is clear that this is a definition. But the trouble is, if he's simply defining a term, then there's no real claim being made. If we define a bachelor as an unmarried man, we still haven't said anything about unmarried men. We've just outlined the way we intend to use a word. As Wittgenstein might put it, bachelors are unmarried is an empty tautological claim. Or as Hume might put it, it is a relation of ideas and not a matter of fact. However, the claim atheists are more religious than they think sounds like it's going to be a Kantian-style transcendental argument. It sounds like it will take an atheist claim and show how it actually assumes some classically religious premise at the outset. At the very least, it sounds like it's going to be about atheists. C.S. Lewis has a famous example of this, where he argues that atheists presuppose reason and that reason can only be accounted for in non-physical terms. Thus, the materialist atheist is caught in a performative contradiction. This is quite an ambitious argument, and even though I've critiqued it very heavily, it does attempt to make a substantive claim about the commitment an atheist might have to the existence of non-physical stuff. I just don't think the atheist is, on balance, committed to the non-physical stuff. But if the term religious is just used to denote the realm of value and meaning, then Peterson's claim about atheists being more religious than they think is just claiming that atheists value things. But I think that most atheists would admit to valuing things. I certainly would. And so the idea that atheists are secretly religious or secretly committed to religious ideas turns out to reference a far wider concept than is ordinarily meant by religious. It's a bit like if I said all religions are secretly atheistic, but then defined atheism to be merely a belief in the existence of material things. The statement would seem like it's demonstrating something about religions or religious people, but that would only be because I am defining atheism in a very strange way. In fact, the classic theistic premises remain untouched. Next, we have an interesting exchange between one speaker and Peterson.
So do you believe in the all-knowing, all-powerful, all-good notion of God?
What do you mean by believe?
Do you think it to be true?
That's the circular definition. What do you mean when you say you believe?
How is that circular?
Because you added no content to the answer by substituting the word true and believe.
I said you think it to be true.
All right. So If you believe something, you stake your life on it.
What do you mean by that?
You live for it, and you die for it. That's what I mean by that.
This is all about Peterson's definition of belief, which is kind of tricky. In the past, I considered Peterson to simply say that belief is potential action. That is, I can only believe something if that belief implies that I will do certain things. So if I believe it will rain, that necessarily means that, all else being equal, I will take an umbrella with me when I go outside, at least provided I have one to hand. This would place Peterson firmly in the tradition of American pragmatism. But here, he says that belief is something that you stake your life on. This is such a bold claim, which, on the face of it, can seem kind of silly. I believe that my desk is here in front of me, but I wouldn't die for that belief. To steelman this point, I think that Peterson must just be talking about religious or moral belief, because otherwise I'm not sure what he's driving at. It seems like most of our beliefs are not even the kind of thing you could stake your life on in the existence-orienting way that he describes. So, for the sake of argument, let's interpret Peterson as saying that this is the right definition of belief in specifically moral or religious things. I can sort of see where this is coming from, in that I would say that someone who is certain of God's existence probably would die for that belief. And if someone were not willing to die, this is probably evidence of some doubt in God. After all, if you're going to inherit eternal life, then dying shouldn't seem like that big of a deal. I don't think that the same necessarily holds for moral claims. Someone can believe very strongly in utilitarianism, but still fail to enact it through some interfering factor like cowardice or weakness. But that aside, we then get a thought experiment by the speaker, Parker.
I'll give you an example. If you're like in like Nazi Germany, and it is the case that there's like Jewish people in your attic and you're trying to protect them, would you lie to like the Nazis?
I would have done everything I bloody well could, so I wouldn't be in that situation to begin with. It's a hypothetical, and it's not answerable.
You can't answer hypotheticals?
No, I can't answer a hypothetical like
what?
That because
Did
it's
you eat
far...
today?
Parker has quite a good point here, which is that sometimes there are things worth sacrificing certain moral codes for. He gives the example of saving a Jewish family from the Nazis. Peterson's eventual response here is to say that he wouldn't get himself into that situation, presumably because he would have followed his moral code up to that point and so wouldn't have to choose between lying and saving a life. I have a couple of questions about this response. The first is that this seems exactly the kind of situation a morally upright or principled person would get themselves into. They are putting their life at risk for a moral principle and safeguarding innocent lives in the process. The second is that I don't really know why Peterson cannot just say he would lie. After all, one of the benefits of a linear hierarchical structure of values is the ability to say A and B are both moral concerns, but B is a weightier moral concern than A. This seems to happen quite a lot in Christian theology. When Christ says, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's," this seems to suggest that, all else being equal, obey the law, but there might be circumstances where obeying the law would contradict God's law, and God's law must take precedence. I find this part of the debate quite confusing, because this is actually a question Peterson's moral framework can give a straightforward answer to. Peterson instead claims the interlocutor is playing games and then finishes with the following.
Look,
Did you eat today? Don't play games. I'm not playing games.
If you present me with an intractable moral choice that's stripped of context and you back me into a corner, you're playing game. I just told you I would do everything that I could to make sure that I'm never in that situation. By the time you've got there, you've made so many mistakes that there's nothing you can do that isn't a sin.
The trouble is, this is not what you would expect if there were an underlying unity to the moral realm. Then it would seem like this unity would be able to answer any hypothetical. This seems to be a real strength of a totally ordered hierarchy of values. At the very least, it surely should give some guidance. The mere existence of intractable moral dilemmas, as Peterson puts it, suggests that there is not an underlying moral unity, but something slightly more fluid going on. Famously, Jean-Paul Sartre thought that intractable moral choices were not rationally resolvable, but that this is where we participated in crafting our own distinctive moral frameworks. This is a small moment in the context of the whole debate, but it does somewhat undermine Peterson's general idea about the unity of values. If this dilemma is intractable, it suggests that there are different, equally important moral forces pulling Peterson in two different directions. But that doesn't suggest moral unity, but moral divergence. And what's more, irreconcilable moral divergence. But if it's not intractable, then he should be able to give an answer. Eventually, Peterson says he would tell the least amount of lie possible in that situation. This is fine as far as an answer goes, but I'm not sure what actually stops him from giving it in the first place. If I were in Peterson's position here, arguing for his point, I would say something like this, and I'm not going to do the voice. Given that there is a hierarchy of values, we can judge in this scenario that the value of telling the truth is less important than saving the lives of innocent people. We live in a fallen world, and so we should expect these kind of dilemmas. But it's only with a linearly ordered hierarchy of values, with a firm foundation at the bottom, that we can be certain that there will be definite answers to them. On the other hand, if I were posing Peterson a question here, I would ask something like this. Does the existence of intractable moral dilemmas undermine this thesis that there is one unity to values that we can turn to in every situation? Does this not instead point to divergence, even at the fundamental level of morality? The moral dilemma Sartre uses is the following. A young student is living in occupied France during World War II and feels morally compelled to join the resistance, yet he also feels morally compelled to stay and care for his mother, who adores him and would be deeply hurt if he left. It seems like this dilemma is so much more difficult. There is only a potential good to be had fighting the Nazis at this point, since it could still be all for naught and they could win the war. But if they are overcome, then this is an extraordinary amount of good that you've contributed to. On the other hand, this individual fighter might not make much of a difference. And is it worth giving up the smaller but certain good of staying at home to look after his mother and keep her company in service to this possible good of defeating the Nazis? I think that this is a bit more plausible as an intractable dilemma, since there are just so many more moving parts. It involves loyalty to family, loyalty to country, the principle of fighting evil, and so much more. If this can't be resolved, then does it throw doubt on the moral unity idea? But anyway, here is Peterson's third claim.
My next claim is that everybody worships something, including atheists, even though they might not know it.
The first speaker here, Zena, is just great.
So I want to start off with like defining terms. How do you define worship?
Prioritize.
So almost like having a preference over something rather than the other.
It's a hierarchy of preferences.
Yeah.
And you use it to direct your attention.
Right.
So whatever you're attending to, you're worshipping.
First of all, Zena does a brilliant job at pinning down the key terms of the debate. Peterson defines worship as prioritization. That is, you worship something when you attend to it, and so assign it more significance than other things. He defines God here as roughly meaning foundational principle, and establishes that you can have better or worse foundational principles. He thinks that a good one is iterative, applicable to a wide range of situations, and likely to be volunteered to by many people. Weirdly, this is a little bit similar to the baseline criteria of a moral system defined by the moral relativist David B. Wong, but I don't think Peterson would want to be associated with that at all.
In regards to morality, when we talk about the divine, when we talk about God and religion, these moral tenets and religion, right, and God exist as good because it is God, right? So it's self-evident, right? Without any kind of goal or output, this thing is good.
Zena gives quite a theistic point, which is that surely if there is a God, then there is a moral lawgiver that can give us moral prescriptions, even independent of a particular person's end goal. But Peterson responds by saying that definitions of good are necessarily goal-dependent. But at this point, we do seem to be in some kind of moral relativism, where good and bad are defined relative to context. It's just that whereas cultural relativism tends to define these terms relative to culture, Peterson defines them relative to a goal. I'm sure Peterson himself is a moral objectivist, I just don't think it comes across that well here. Again, my issue is that I don't think many atheists would disagree that you can define good or bad relative to a goal. In Kant's work, this is called a hypothetical imperative. They include statements like, if you want to go to the shops, then you ought to take a left turn, and if you want to be financially responsible, it is good to save money each month. But one of the real strengths of religion is that it claims to give you statements about morality independent of any pre-existing aims you might have. It allows you to say, I don't care if you ultimately desire to make loads of money and all your behavior is oriented towards that, that is a bad goal. That's what I imagine the other person means when they say they want a stance-independent idea of goodness from God. Now, Peterson does say we can distinguish between good and bad God, that is, endpoints of worship. And so presumably he does think there is some way of telling between competing moral systems. But the criteria he provides here iterability, voluntary assent, and breadth of application are all things atheists could appeal to as well. Peterson might say this shows they worship those things, but only in the minimal sense that they value them highly. This bears a passing resemblance to religious worship, but I don't think it's totally the same. When I say that I value something highly, that I is important. It retains my ownership over that worship. It's a kind of submission and assent, but it nonetheless recognizes that assent as done by me, and that I could have chosen to submit to something else without being irrational. It retains my agency and my sovereignty. Contrast this with the following statement, again by St. Thomas Aquinas. By the one and same act, man both serves and worships God. For worship regards the excellence of God, to whom reverence is due, while service regards the subjection of man, who, by his condition, is under an obligation of showing reverence to God. Here, worship is partly the recognition of God's excellence and also involves service, but notice the wording. It's not just that the man chooses to show reverence to God, he is obliged to do so. The I has disappeared. Or rather, worship follows from a straightforward acknowledgement of the fact that God is much greater than us and he is perfect. The difference between I value this and place it at the top of my value hierarchy and I recognize the pre-existing value hierarchy inherent in the universe with an omnibenevolent God at the top strikes me as extremely important. The first, any atheist like myself can agree to, but the second, only theists can agree to. We then move on to defining what makes a Christian. Here, Peterson says that to be a Christian is to view the universe as governed by a principle of voluntary self-sacrifice, and also to retain an upward mobilization even in times of great despair. We get a genuinely quite helpful distinction between acting out Christian ethics and believing in Christian propositions, and Peterson says that acting out a Christian pattern is much more important than believing a bunch of Christian ideas. He talks about the notion of a noble pagan, the kind of people who were not damned to hell despite not believing in the Gospels since they lived before the coming of Christ. My question here would be, is the situation not different after the coming of Christ? For example, it is a theme amongst medieval theologians that virtuous pagans may have been a phenomenon before Christ, but in a post-resurrection world, only very few non-Christians would ever be able to enter the kingdom of God, or at least so they claim. The professor of medieval philosophy, John Maraborn, has argued that while many medieval theologians might allow someone like Plato or Aristotle into heaven, or at least not damn them to hell, this is largely because they didn't even have the opportunity to know Christ. We now have no such excuse, and this implicit faith idea is unlikely to exonerate any of us. So I think that this does raise a pretty significant challenge to Peterson's position. According to the medieval theologians he is citing, acting as a Christian is probably equally as important as believing in Christian doctrine propositionally, as they are both borderline necessary conditions to attain salvation. It's also worth noting that Dante's Divine Comedy has much discussion of noble pagans, but they tended to be before Christ, not after him. Now we're back to the claim that atheists worship something, and after some back and forth, we get the following definition of worship, which is subtly different and more expanded to the previous one.
There's a hierarchy of attentional priority, and as you move up it or down it, depending on whether you think about it as a pinnacle or a foundation, you move more towards worship. Right, okay. So even the small things, I'll give you an example. Imagine you go on a date. Mm-hmm. Well, and imagine that your aim is a long-term relationship, sure, like a marriage. Okay, now imagine that your aim is short-term sexual gratification. Your pattern of attention is going to vary during the date, depend on your ultimate end. That's the hierarchy.
Here, we get the addition of shades of worship. So we have the image of a scale of priority with God at the top. And as we approach this God, we get closer and closer to worship. I don't have any issue with this in principle. I'm actually an enormous fan of using gradability in philosophy. However, I think this is yet another example of framing what could be quite an everyday phenomenon in unnecessarily religious language. I get that when a believer uses God as their endpoint of value, that is similar to when an atheist utilitarian might use the greatest net happiness as their endpoint of value, but rather than say the atheist is religious, I would just say they're both doing versions of the same everyday event, using a set of criteria to decide what they're going to do and how they're going to make decisions. You can call that religious if you like, but that doesn't make it anything metaphysical. Peterson then distinguishes between having a moral unity and being fragmented and confused.
It's a hierarchy of prioritization. And there's something, there's either something at the top or the bottom, depending on the metaphor, or you're fragmented and confused. Those are the only options.
So let's say
you're either going in many directions,
okay,
or you're going in one direction.
My question here would be, is there any time it is appropriate to be confused about a moral decision? Would it be a virtue for the student in our earlier example to be able to answer his dilemma instantly and confidently, or would we say he's being flippant and not grappling with the real difficulties of the dilemma at play? It seems like this emphasis on moral decisiveness could lead us to never question our moral foundations or wonder if there are any alternatives. Would this not prevent the very kind of moral change Peterson often praises, like the abolition of slavery? Isn't changing your value system only possible if you do have some baseline uncertainty within your value hierarchy? Peterson seems to implicitly assume that moral fragmentation is always a bad thing, but I would say it is also the precondition for any moral improvement and indeed any moral change. The other speaker, Gerard, offers a fantastic analogy here with great literature.
Do you think there is a hierarchy in literary quality?
I think that there is a hierarchy to an extent in literary quality, but I think once you get to a certain threshold, it is just opinion. Like, I agree, Dostoevsky is better than a Macbeth. Is F. Scott Fitzgerald better than Ernest Hemingway? I don't know.
It is easy to say that Dostoevsky is better literature than a Playboy magazine, but is it easy to say he is better than Stendhal or Flaubert? Who's the better writer, Tolstoy or Shakespeare? Well, they're each better at different things. Dostoevsky and Stendhal are unparalleled psychological writers, while Tolstoy's actual writing is unbelievably beautiful, as is Flaubert's. Shakespeare is, unsurprisingly, probably the best dramatist and certainly has the most thrilling pacing. It seems we use many different criteria to define great literature, and that when we compare two authors who are comparably great but on different metrics, we do struggle to make a decision between them. We are in a literary dilemma. But I would say this does not make us fragmented or confused. It demonstrates the appropriate level of humility about judging between great writers. This underlying claim that absolute unity in values is always a good thing seems to me to be highly questionable. But if I could ask a couple of questions to Peterson here, it would be the following. What is the word worship doing here that the simple word prioritization would not? And if they are interchangeable, then in what sense is this a religious question?
My final claim is that atheists accept Christian morality, but deny the religion's foundational stories.
Honestly, I don't know how much I disagree with this claim. I think it depends on exactly how you cash out the term Christian morality. Oftentimes in debates like this, there are at least two definitions at play. One is the kind of loose idea of Christian morality that denotes some of the received ethical system we have today, which has undeniably been influenced by Christianity, since that was the dominant line of thinking for almost 2,000 years. But alongside this, there is the definition of Christian morality as the morality contained within the Bible itself. That is, that atheists do accept the morality in the Bible, yet deny the truth of the stories in the Bible. I could see how atheists might subscribe to the first definition of Christian morality, but I think the second is a little bit more spurious.
So in 1 Samuel 15:3, God says, go and slaughter the Amalekites, slaughter the men, the women, the children, the infants. What's the justification for that? Is that in line with Christian ethics?
That's a good question.
This first speaker raises a pretty neat objection to the idea that our current ethical system is the same as it was in the Old Testament. He points to the slaughter of the Amalekites as just one example of how that Christian morality would differ from our own Christian morality. Peterson responds to this in a number of different ways, but essentially he ends up suggesting that God and God's commands are perfect, but we have imperfectly interpreted his will throughout history, and this is what has led to religious atrocities.
Imagine something that's perfect.
Sure.
And complete.
Sure.
Okay, and it's trying to communicate with creatures who are anything but that.
Sure.
Well, they're going to get it wrong.
Sure.
Okay, but now wait a sec. Do you blame that on the interpreters or the phenomena itself?
As far as a theodicy goes, I think this may raise more questions than it answers. For example, it's now a little bit mysterious why God would not correct us when we misunderstand him so profoundly. Take the slaughter of the Amalekites. It is one thing to say that this was somehow for the best, or to make an active moral defense, or even to just hand wave it and say that God works in mysterious ways, and we shouldn't expect to make sense of him all the time. But to say that the Israelites misunderstood God in that instance, when they were, at least according to the Bible, receiving orders directly from him, makes it unclear why, when the massacre of the Amalekites was actually going on, God did not pipe up and let them know that they were misunderstanding him to such an extreme extent, especially considering that in the book of Samuel, Saul's disobedience to God is meant to be the fact that he spared the king of the Amalekites and took some of their livestock rather than just slaughtering them as well. I think Peterson's strongest response here would just be to say that the Israelites were not actually directly commanded by God in this way, but this is the symbolic record of what they thought was the right thing to do by their laws. Since, as far as I know, he's not committed to biblical infallibility, this response does seem open to him, so I'm a little bit surprised he doesn't give it. I also wanted to highlight this line by Peterson.
Wait a sec, you said find one... maxim that's transcendent across situations.
I didn't say any of those words.
I thought for a second he was going to say, don't threaten visiting lecturers with pokers. However, I think in some ways, the example of biblical stories is overall a bit of a red herring. My challenge would be, okay, let's admit that we, in some minimal sense, have a Christian morality, in that Christianity was the dominant religion in Europe for over 1,000 years. But if, in that time, there has been radical moral change, like the abolition of slavery or the abolition of serfdom or women's suffrage or even parliamentary democracy itself, then in what way is the Christian morality we have now the same as the Christian morality we had in the reign of the Emperor Constantine? I'm not denying that Christianity has had a profound impact on our moral history, but I think that the link to these foundational stories seems to have been mediated through quite a large amount of other causal factors, such that an atheist upholding that morality while denying the truth of its foundational stories doesn't seem on its face as necessarily a problem. Earlier in the video, Peterson claimed that these moral developments were the flowering of originally Christian ideas, and I'm not inherently opposed to this point, but I think it does need a further argument. Ultimately, we need to establish what distinguishes a moral flowering from a genuine moral change. For example, there are verses in the Bible that people have used to legitimize slavery, like Paul's proclamation of slaves obey your masters. Most Christians today view that as a misuse of the passage, but at the time it was not viewed in this way by many, many people who did use it to support slavery. Likewise, Peterson takes the book of Exodus as a condemnation of all slavery, but evidently these 18th century theologians didn't take it this way. Are both the pro-slavery and anti-slavery versions of this argument the flowering of Christian ideas? And if not, how do we distinguish a flowering from a misuse of a Christian idea? Obviously, this is a huge part of the whole field of biblical interpretation, but I do think we need to adopt some sort of rigorous methodology here for Peterson's point about moral flowering to hit home. Next, we have Liam, who gets right in with this question.
My question to you, let me scoot in, would be, what does it mean to accept Christian values precisely, or Christian morality?
It means to aim up as hard as you can, no matter what happens to you.
Okay.
So Liam points out that this definition is underspecified. That is, it can pick out more than one religious or ethical system. So if I were a Buddhist, I would also be called to aim up no matter what happens to me. In fact, it seems like any value system is going to ask you to aim up no matter what, since it will incorporate some variant of the commandment, do the best that you can to follow these values. Peterson clarifies this is not an exhaustive definition and then follows it up with this.
I could say that you would have to believe that Christ is God and he died for your sins, mm-hmm. right? But that's, in a very difficult way to understand, that's the same claim.
Yeah.
So I would obviously dispute the idea that these are the same claim. I think that aiming up no matter what is one lesson of Christianity, exemplified in the idea of picking up your cross and following Christ, but I don't think it is equivalent to saying that Christ is God and died for our sins. If it were equivalent, we would be able to infer exactly the same things from each statement, and I just don't think we can, and I don't see any good reason to think that we can. We then get this interesting exchange.
So if you take inspiration from Christian ideas, then insofar as you do that, you are in fact a believer, which was my point with regards to atheists
Correct.
Not understanding.
But have you taken
rejecting.
Inspiration from Taoism or from studying Egyptian mythology?
Definitely.
So then you believe them under that definition?
Yeah, but I've incorporated them into something I think that's more comprehensive.
This is pretty significant. Peterson says that he does believe in these other religions in this sense of being inspired by them, but he's incorporated them into Christianity as that is more comprehensive. This, at the very least, suggests that he is using the word belief in a radically different way to most people. He argues that his belief in these other religions and in Christianity involves some idea of enacted truth or enacted belief. But if so, then Peterson is sort of suggesting that any Christian is also a believer in all of the theological antecedents to Christianity, including the pagan ones. But I just don't think this is how most Christians would see things. But then this brings us back to this point of underspecification. Liam rightly points out that if, when I act, I'm not just enacting Christianity, but all of these other religions, then it seems Peterson's claim about accepting Christian morality is not just about Christianity, but about morality much more generally. But I don't think that an atheist would have a problem saying, I recognize that my moral system causally arose from a multifaceted religious past involving many different faiths, but I nonetheless reject those faiths while accepting that this moral system I've inherited is something valuable. In some ways, Christian thinkers do a similar thing constantly. St. Augustine rejected the pagan origins of Neoplatonism, but still thought it was a beautiful philosophical system and heavily incorporated it into his theology. Aquinas's ethical and metaphysical ideas are heavily influenced by Aristotle, but he too rejected that pagan origin. Taking something from previous traditions while rejecting the traditions themselves is pretty par for the course in the development of ideas. I think what Peterson needs is an argument for the necessity of believing in Christian stories for the maintenance of a version of our current morality. And I don't want to rule out a priori that there might be such an argument. I just think that it's a missing link that would really aid Peterson's point here. If you do want someone who argues for this conclusion, Glenn Scrivener over at SpeakLife has made a number of arguments to this effect, but we don't have time to get into them here. The next speaker, Kamari, raises the question of heaven and hell. Peterson gives a characteristically unmetaphysical answer, where he says he just can't say anything about what happens after death, but that hell is defined as something worldly that you would do anything to get out of. He also argues that a number of ideas, like recognizing your mistakes and improving and forgiving sins, are Christian. The trouble is that these aren't all distinctly Christian. I'll grant that the idea that all sin is forgivable is much more prevalent in Christianity than in a lot of other faiths, but recognizing your mistakes and improving is not just a Christian idea. We find it in the stories of ancient Greek heroes, in Buddhist monks achieving enlightenment, and even in secular myths about achieving your dreams. And so again, we encounter this same difficulty, specification. I would wager that very few Christians would appreciate me accusing them of implicitly believing in Greek myths when they talk about making mistakes and improving. They would probably respond with something like, I get that aspects of Christian narratives are also there in some ancient Greek myths. The difference is, the Christian narrative is true. It actually happened. This is why I think that Peterson's definition of God and belief seem to strip away much of what actually matters to theists about theistic faith, and to atheists like myself about denying theistic faith. So my question to Peterson here would be pretty simple. How does his definition of religious belief, where you are, in some sense, committed to all the beliefs that inspired your own, allow the Christian to uphold the first command, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me"? That is, how does this notion of religious belief allow the Christian to remain monotheistic? Finally, we have the last 10-minute discussion.
My claim is Jordan Peterson's framework for understanding Christianity is probably not the one that the Bible intended us to use.
Zena is back with another cracking question. Essentially, how does Peterson know that his interpretation of the Bible is correct? When he says that the story of Cain and Abel, or the Tower of Babel, or the Flood are meant to be meta-truths and places far less importance on whether these events actually occurred, how do we know if he is right in this interpretation? Peterson's response here is thoroughly pragmatic. He says that people have found his interpretations helpful and enlightening, and this shows that he's onto something. He later says that an interpretation being welcoming or likely to be voluntarily submitted to might be good criteria for its evaluation. This may be the case, but as Zena points out, if God exists, then what matters is not whether our interpretations of scripture are helpful, but whether they correspond to God's will. This does seem really important if you are a thoroughgoing Christian, or even if you're just an agnostic seeking God. If I read the Bible with a mind to possibly be convinced, I don't just want to be convinced that it contains helpful allegorical lessons, but that it represents the will of a perfect, omnipotent, omniscient God. We then have the following exchange.
We need to know how we should interpret the things that the Bible says. And
Many ways.
Right, but like, if we interpret...
Sometimes poetry, sometimes history, well, sometimes fact,
but
sometimes
for example,
metaphor.
The reason why it's important, right, very important, is because, for example, we can talk about something like God says, I believe it's like 1 Corinthians 15:17, something about how belief in God specifically as someone who resurrected or as someone who died for our sins is important, right? But we have to look at, if we can interpret that as just like, you have to believe that God is a symbol of sacrifice, that is different from believing that there was an actual person named Jesus Christ who died on the cross
for
our sins.
That's true.
Zena raises a very good point here, which is that whatever the case for the symbolic or poetic parts of the Bible, clearly there are aspects of it that we need to take as representative of historical fact if we are to be Christians. I think the Corinthians passage Zena is referring to is probably the following, though I am happy to be corrected. If it is preached that Christ has been raised from the dead, how can some of you say that there is no resurrection of the dead? If there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. More than that, we are then found to be false witnesses about God, for we have testified about God that he raised Christ from the dead. But he did not raise him if in fact the dead are not raised, for if the dead are not raised, then Christ has not been raised either. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins. The point I think Zena wants to get across here is that there are aspects of the biblical stories, and in particular the New Testament, that Christians have to believe in a historical sense. And the scriptures specifically say that we ought to believe them in a historical sense. Paul is not just a mystical figure in a quasi-legendary past, and this is not merely a prophetic document. It is a letter, reportedly written by an actual guy who actually lived, attempting to communicate his theology as clearly and unambiguously as possible. The same general idea is echoed in the Nicene Creed, where we are called to believe that Christ suffered death and was buried, and rose again on the third day in accordance with the scriptures. He ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of the Father. He will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead. These are claims about future observations and past events. Sure, there is rich symbolism, but there's also a straightforwardly propositional component to this. To say this is not to reduce Christianity down to merely the propositional, but simply to recognize the propositional component of a multi-layered text. So my question here is this: what do we do with the historical or observational claims of Christianity under Peterson's framework? Are they irrelevant, or is asking this question simply the wrong approach? But if it is the wrong approach, then have all of these acclaimed Christian thinkers, from St. Paul to everyone at the Council of Nicaea, just been wrong about Christianity and religion? Okay, so that was the debate. What can we take away from it? Definitions, interpretations, and being. I know that Peterson has got a lot of flack for this debate, but there are also things that all of us can learn from these exchanges, and one of them is the pesky vagueness in the word is. Alfred Korzybski was an intensely original Polish thinker who worked on many, many things. But among these was a detailed analysis of the verb to be, and by extension, is. I can't go into Korzybski's whole system now, and I'm not even 100% sure that I really understand it in its totality, but perhaps his most famous observation about is was the distinction between the is of identity and the is of predication. To use the is of identity is to say that two things are equivalent, like when I say a prime number is a number that is only divisible by one and itself, or a triangle is a three-sided polygon. I'm not simply saying that a triangle happens to be a three-sided polygon. I'm saying that these two concepts are totally identical. We used another example earlier with a bachelor is an unmarried man. This is not saying that bachelors happen to be unmarried, but that a bachelor is identical to an unmarried man. the concepts are interchangeable and thus inferentially equivalent. The is of predication is when we say something like, Joe is a YouTuber or the desk is wooden. I'm not identical to the concept YouTuber, nor is the desk identical to the concept wooden. These are just properties or predicates of the subject in the sentence. But where am I going with this? Well, a lot of the confusion in this debate comes where the two uses of the verb to be are run together. When Peterson says, God is conscience and that's a definition, it's quite unclear whether he is using the is of identity or the is of predication. If it's the is of identity and God just is conscience and nothing more, then the whole debate seems trivial because the atheist does not deny the existence of conscience. If he is instead using the is of predication and God is your conscience and a whole bunch of other things, then the use of the term definition seems a little bit misleading, since a definition normally means that you are outlining the necessary and sufficient conditions for the usage of a term. If I said, a triangle is a shape with at least two sides, and that's a definition, you would be forgiven for thinking that I meant four-sided shapes were also triangles. With this distinction in mind, the contours of the debate become a little bit clearer. Whenever Peterson uses a property to define God, we can ask, is this term identical to God, or is it just one of God's defining properties? If it's the first, then by his definitions, there is often no dispute between Peterson and the atheist. And if it's the second, then a full definition of God has not yet been provided, and the debate can't properly proceed until the rest of the definition is filled in. Likewise, when Peterson says that belief is what you stake your life on, is this an is of identity, where anything you do not stake your life on, you do not properly believe? Or is this just one of the things that can characterize belief, along with a whole heap of other properties? And this is really only the start of the definitional chaos in this debate. There are also disputes about what religion means, what Christian means, and whether inspiration implies belief. Each of these needs a clear definition at the outset, and for that definition to be agreed upon by all participants. I know this sounds a bit strange, but watching this debate is almost like watching someone speak a slightly different dialect of English. Peterson's usage of these terms is never so odd that it's immediately obvious that he and the speaker are talking about different things, but it also clearly does diverge from ordinary usage, and this makes any substantive debate almost impossible to have. This was one of the least productive discussions I have seen for a while. And it's not really because of the times that Peterson got angry, but just because the whole debate was chock full of so many differences in definitions that very little communication went on at all. There were a number of times where, when you get down to it, Peterson was giving a straightforward, pretty much non-religious argument, and then defining a lot of religious terminology much more broadly than in common parlance so that he can use those terms in his argument. This is part of what gives the debate this slightly fog-like feel. The language of religion is being used to make arguments that very few people would recognize as religious. Often Peterson's arguments are something that any atheist could accept, and indeed, I accept a lot of them, and so there's often not much substantial disagreement. But at the same time, the whole context and framing of the video makes it seem like there are going to be substantial disagreements. So the whole thing has the vibe of two people shadowboxing on opposite sides of a room while the other reacts as if they're getting hit. Jordan Peterson has become almost notorious for his use of the phrase, what do you mean by that? And this is an excellent question to ask, but we can't just stop there. We eventually have to answer it. We need to agree on definitions and then figure out if there is any actual dispute to be had. This is part of why so many early 20th century analytic philosophers were so keen on defining terms. They were convinced that a lot of disagreements, both philosophical and non-philosophical, were simply confusions of language. And this included people using the same words in different ways without realizing it. And in the case of this debate, I think they were probably right. If you want to check out another of my videos on Peterson's work, you can catch my review on his new book, We Who Wrestle With God, right here. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.